Hello and welcome. We are a collective of artists and researchers at Central St Martins, and our work, our research and our practice is around practices of landscape, site and place. The piece we're doing today is a response to the invitation to present and participate in this event.
How many signs like these do I come across every day without being able to read them? East Tilbury is itself an interface. The estuary is half ocean, half land. Each a force that shapes their respective morphologies. But it is this unstable nature that has prevented this site from acquiring value, and it is therefore this fact of being an interface that has decided its fate to become landfill. So, what started as a landfill had to become, and is becoming, an ocean fill.
A house that has been experienced is not an American box.
Is it here? What's there? Wait, the monologue is down there.
Bricks and shoes, clothing, plastics, batteries, motor parts.
Landfill. Earthworms cannot survive in the toxic density of landfill.
Land. Upon the chalk sits silten sand.
Land. Open by hand, it is
filled.
Turn anti-clockwise. Who opened
Land.
It? How many times?
Landfill.
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 No. Landfill.
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 Fill.
Darwin's Worms is a book as much about geology as it is about worms. Apart from his detailed examination of the anatomy and behavior of worms, Darwin devotes a large part of his book to discuss the part which worms have played in the burial of ancient buildings through their digestion and displacement of soil, raising the level of soil around the buildings. This takes millennia.
The absence of people lets the building as an object or as a box reflect back to our society.
Dogs. Next bone fragments. Meals. Tables. Not vacated.
Yes, it's shorelines are tested.
Every part of landfill should be seen as vital and recyclable.
The river lays east of Tilbury.
There is a six-pointed star inside, and five different symbols with each point.
The place where most of the 7 million tons of waste we produce in London per year goes.
Landfills.
On Sunday, October 6th, some of the Sensing Site research group took a train from Furniture Street Station in the heart of the city to East Tilbury, South Essex. We were on the trail to what we had heard was a coastal landfill site leaching into the waters of the River Thames. Arriving at the station, we found that no bus service that day. So we would have to walk the 2 kilometers or so to Coalhouse Wharf, our destination. Our walk led us south along a noisy, busy road past a river of modest, semi-detached houses, something in their design just visible behind their various additions and replacements, hinting at an architectural vision out of the norm. Checking our route, we stopped off a large, cluttered supermarket with which, with its stockpile, seemed like the last outpost of civilization.
The objects are absent of their owners.
I unearthed a bleached strip of celluloid film, mottled and rusted with accumulated matter and tangled with root filaments.
One can begin to see that it is only in the smallest regions of highly localized microgeographies or habitats that birds can truly differentiate itself.
Our viral activity hardly facilitates a regeneration of the planet.
and there another layer of peat, estuary, geology.
Two rectangles then move on the short side. A blessed sign and a recycling symbol.
Landfill. To feel the land.
Landfill.
But yeah, he talks about sites, these heterotopic sites, and being real or mental spaces that also act as another space alongside the existing space. So, I know this sounds wishy-washy, but I suppose it's landfill, but it's also so many other things. And I think that's what he's kind of getting at with these heterotopic spaces, and he has some principles under which you think about a space and whether it's heterotopic. And one is that it's, from my understanding, sort of real and also reflective. So it has a precise and determined function, which is also reflective of the society in which it exists. And he uses the example of a cemetery, that it is linked to everybody within a community, and that maybe has some relationship to the way in which we are all linked to the objects in the landfill.
But what's distinctive about going to a landfill site and point that resonates with you?
Well, Steve's glass, and I think partially burned coal waste or coke.
The valuable part of the plant's claim in the Canadian soil is well known.
Land. The humans alter, adjust, and reshape resources.
The river lays east Tilbury.
When you enter the storyline of an object, you receive the full power of its good.
Because it goes to landfill or basurero or vertedero, Spanish terms for landfill.
If all landfill across the planet was sifted, valuable material could be continually reclaimed. Fungal agents can also construct new earth. Swift fungal mycelium productivity needs to compensate for human acceleration of land degradation. As a global priority, funguses and earthworms need to consume the now never-ending residue of human consumption to stop planet erosion and extinction.
Especially when you think about how much waste is probably produced by those people.
Landfill.
Broken many times. Breaking right now.
Landfill.
Currently the human species, like a virus, seems ill-equipped to maintain equilibrium.
Fine-grained sand and thin clay beds.
It feels like stumbling into a sad image of oneself. A complex sensation where the memory of lived experience re-emerges, confronted by its physical leftovers and rejections.
Well, the place where you pull things out.
Landfill.
Holding a smooth piece of ceramic, it is crackled with lines. Failure, failure path, and boundaries of strength are revealed within these stress patterns. Upon the chalk sits silt and sand. The river lays east Tilbury. Homogeneous and fissured clay. Estuary, geology. Vertedero. The place where you pull things out.
The process of the field trip started even before getting to Tilbury.
Enthralled and repelled at the same time.
The truth is, we need to produce less. Many landfill sites are creating methane gas.
Domestic plastic twine and cloth.
And out keep walking, searching for another way to be.
Do people have questions that you'd like to ask of the sensing side?
Yeah, I was just wondering.
Sure.
No mention of scent, smell, landfill. I've been a landfill site, and there's always an aroma.
I need to explain that these are short texts that are taken from much longer texts.
Could you use the microphone? Sorry.
Yes. Okay, you still can't hear.
Well, that one's probably better.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah, this is actually working. I should explain that these are extracts that we've worked on together from much longer, larger texts. And in fact, we do at a certain point, certain texts do refer to smell. But there's a certain amount of contingency and randomness to how we've put this together as a collective piece. So we all have much longer texts, but this is just the way it fell in working together, and that's kind of what we wanted to do as an experiment, because this is the way our conversations unravel and come together.
We can add also, this is the old landfill, so it's in East Tilbury. You can see parade from the surface, but it's not an open landfill, only smell. So you will smell the sea,
yeah,
the estuary, but you don't smell the landfill. So that's quite important.
Yeah. And the site that we went to do this kind of strange sort of excavation of, so it's a former landfill, but down by the river the material is starting to appear as the rising waters of the Thames have eroded the bank of the river, it's in some ways kind of hidden landscape. You wouldn't know it was there unless you, in terms of the exposed landscape, and unless you went along the river to walk, find it. We spent a bit of time looking for it.
And I just wanted to add that some of us didn't go. I didn't go. So I couldn't smell it. but the thing is that we all have a sense of landfill in our head. You were referring, Anu was referring to landfills back home or where you do your research. And so the idea of a landfill is somehow abstracted when the smell comes in, it becomes very real. So I am very interested in what you said, but while we were doing the work, maybe actually the sound was a landfill, or the idea that we have that could be just put into thoughts or action anywhere.
We're sharing this microphone around. I'd like to add that, you know, this our process, our methodology, our way of trying to understand or in any way sense that was itself subject to a process of chopping and reprocessing, being buried, being unearthed again, and being resorted. And in some ways, you know, one of the ways I was so interested in being part of this event is how, in exploring how that resonates with some of these themes that have come up already today about a multiplicity, about porosity, and absolutely, you know, the process. I mean, we all shared and exchanged the bits of text that we read, so there's a degree of collaboration and non-identity and exchanging with these contingent perceptions that we have reordered in a semi random way.
This is the first time we've done this. This is, I mean, we kind of we kind of made this piece specifically for this symposium, but we think of it as a work in progress. So this will develop into potentially a number of different forms. It may become just simply a sound piece in its own right. We might continue to perform it. We're certainly interested in the idea of what has happened in the process of amalgamating our individual texts and what arises as a result of that as well.
I might say something in the sense that we're within an art school, so, and we are within academia. So we occupy a sensing site, which is the name of our group, occupies a kind of interesting fracture, if you like, between the institution and between us as a research group who are all practicing artists. And I think for us to research and produce work like this is really important because it's outside of a certain kind of instrumentalization that goes on with academia. And I think as Stephen has just said, this was a first experiment, which is it's about the process for us. And I think that's really important that we're not working for certain kinds of outputs at all. And we have to push against the grain with that quite often in what we do.
Hi everybody. So earlier one of the speakers was talking about music soundscapes, and I wasn't at the rehearsal earlier today when they were rehearsing this, but I've heard different mixes over the last couple of weeks, and obviously I've read some of the texts, etc. But for me to hear this now, it conjures up images and conjures up aspects of landscape that might be very sort of small microcosm. I'm sorry, I can't say that right now. And it creates an imaginary, perhaps, visual landscape, but it's also about a real place that's sitting on the estuary, leaking. We're speaking human trash into the water, into the sea. And one of the things that Stephen sent a link to a video to do with the biggest landfill sites across the planet. This is a few weeks ago. One of the biggest landfill sites is actually in the sea. So you can watch this video, it's on YouTube. You'll see these different sites and how these sites are overpiled. They've gone beyond what the restrictions are supposed to be, and they're continually piling up things higher and higher, which is obviously a very unsafe process, and unsafe for any of the communities human or non-human around it. This is part of the landscape that humans are creating. So it's my bit for now.
Yeah, and thanks to the guys for doing the performance, because myself and Kate couldn't be there. But I think following on from that, what was important about going to East Tilbury was the idea that we can think about these things in the abstract or in the theoretical sense, but we decided as an exercise to get our train and just go and experience a place and come back and reflect sort of separately and then come together and think. And I suppose it just maybe speaks to some of the things about how can you use a metaphor or use something that we can hold on to try and think of practical solutions. It was definitely a coming between a theoretical space to a practical space, which I found really useful about the exercise.
Thank you. Oh, sorry.
Questions?
Just really quickly, I just wanted to sort of mark out that the landfill repeated tone you had going through there. Halfway through, I thought, this is reminding me of something. And just to share that with you, and I remember what it was I heard Dan Graham give a performance of Relax, So he just says relax for about 50 minutes, very, very slowly, increasingly slowly. And then, so it was very lovely to hear you speak, but also I was going, landfill, relax, in my head.
Thank you. Mine's actually also related to the repetition of the word. And there was one intonation that immediately made me think minefield, landfill, minefield. And I thought it was quite interesting because you talked about process and you talked also about that you had to go find it, you didn't know what was underneath. And in your process, have you thought also about like landscape, warscape? Because there is a lot of conversation about ecological destruction and partly ecological warring and that kind of thing. And I'm sorry if this is a bit of a tangent.
No, we haven't. There were some other readings. Somebody this morning said they heard landfill as
Grenfell. Yes.
So that whole question of what you hear and what you imagine you hear is an aspect. But we haven't talked about war. We've talked a lot about the visibility and perhaps the uncanniness of that site, which is on a threshold, which you brought up earlier. Of continuously leaching into the Thames while the river level is rising at the same time. And the fact that it's located East Tilbury, you probably know, in Essex, which has always been a dumping site. It's been a site of extraction of raw materials, and it's been a site of dumping waste in those holes. So those two industries are very, very linked together economically and politically. But there's a real interest. But it's kind of like it's always been rubbish to us.
And now it's the site where the soil from the Crossrail tunneling is being. So the idea apparently is that this soil will help to produce arable land. But it's the same process. It's an area that has become, as Susan said, the dumping ground for stuff that London doesn't want, basically.
It's interesting that you had the word relax in your head, Andrew, because I can't remember who it was. Someone described these as anxious landscapes, and that's certainly how I experienced the repetition of the word landfill. Thank you so much for that, for
thank
presenting
you
and sharing the process
thank you.
With us.
Introduction to the next and final section, actually, which is practicing, because I wanted to begin with the idea of the edge and move outward from there. One of the 12 principles of permaculture is to value the edge and value the marginal and extend the edge where possible, and it's seen as a way, well, it is a way in which ecologies and environmental sectors can meet one another. You extend the edge of things and remove straight lines, then you provide more niches and opportunities for things to encounter one another and come into being. And it's one of the sort of underlying principles of biodiversity and how biodiversity can be maintained and regenerated. I think it applies very much to social environments as well as to urban environments. Jan Jacobs spoke about the importance of random encounter and opportunities within urban spaces for people to meet with one another. So it's, I think it's an important way of thinking about making at every level. I wanted to, and I like that idea of the, well, love, I'm interested in the idea of the landfill as a space, a site that bleeds into the sea, as well as emerging on land. It's an emergent environment and therefore unpredictable. And so these ideas of unpredictability, uncertainty, emergence, and extended non-linear journeying, they seem to me to be very important in this new section, which is where I want to talk a little bit about the skills, the knowledges, and the collaborations involved in thinking and acting productively in response to climate change. So, what I wanted to start with was by asking the makers here how their work could be seen to extend the edges of things to move in a non-linear and often unpredictable way. Amanda, I'm going to start with you because you're right there.
So yeah, I suppose the thing we say that my work in Abernethy is completely based on repeated visits and what repeated visits bring, but it's also related to the different voices that you can bring in to these repeated visits. So for my PhD work, I was partly anthropological, and I did, I suppose, what you'd either call participant observation or actually more observant participation. So as part of my PhD, I walked with foresters and ecologists. I volunteered with the RSPB. So I was inland and I was learning about land from all these different perspectives. And that fed into the kind of work I was making, because I was learning and seeing the land differently. I was seeing the reserve from completely different perspectives. I was seeing the reserve from being out with an ecologist looking for regeneration, the mapping regeneration along transects for 6 hours. I was walking with a deer stalker on their ship. So all of these things were coming and feeding into the different narratives of place I was building. So I actually very rarely make a piece of work that says a whole story. I'm very much interested in how you can gather these different elements that start to tell a story of place, or start to tell and speak to the multi-layers of place. Also, as part of my PhD and my practices, I'm really interested in the... It's interesting, Ruth talks about edges and margins. I'm more interested in the bleeds and the porosities, and how you can pull different languages in to kind of tell different elements of the same story, or speak to different ways in which the story can be told. So, for example, these moments where actually the place speaks for itself in a sound work, you know, where you can kind of tell it's an early morning, you can hear the geese in the loch or something like that, but that becomes interspersed with other stuff that you perhaps see. I don't know, can I just show a couple of... I can't think what though.
Walking the...
Yeah, so if you go to the... See the walk drawings?
Yep.
So I'm really interested, for example, in how you move through space. And what I do and have been doing kind of for over a decade now is using a GPS to track the ways I walk through land. And it started with walking specifically. So this piece is a walk which was a 2-day walk in Glen Tanner with an ecologist looking for regeneration and deer browsing, so we could try and kind of estimate deer numbers. And you can look at this piece in lots of different ways. You can look at it from this map on the top, which is very specific about the area of land covered and the way that we walked in order to count the regeneration. That you can look at it kind of more artistically, in inverted commas, where you think about clay taking a line for a walk. So everything is reduced to actually a photopolymer etching, where you're reduced to the line and maybe these hints of what the walk is in relation to the scale at the bottom and the grid at the top. But it becomes very reduced and almost very aesthetic in quality. Like, so if you go to the next one, That's a walk drawn of an archaeological survey where you can see in the centre point the amount of time we spent tracing around the deserted croft, and then the exterior points or the sweeps around the edges of the land to see if we could find any kind of traces of agriculture or agricultural machinery that were left. The next one is another walk for regeneration where you can see the transects that we walked, and you can see the road that we walked to get to the transects in order to start the regeneration plans. The next one is a really interesting one in lots of different ways, because as a volunteer with the RSPB we were walking to find non-native species to reduce, well, basically to cut them down, to make it more natural.
Right.
So all of these things were taking place within these other pieces of research and finding it I was doing. So if I go into, I don't know, say, yeah, not this one. Is there ringing? Constant effort? Yeah, up at the top.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So, all of these walks speak to Abernethy Forest. Constant effort is this other thing that's going on in Abernethy Forest, or just beyond Abernethy Forest, which is bird ringing. And so, it gives you a completely different aesthetic, a completely different energy, a completely different feeling to what the place might be about. So I found bird ringing really interesting because it was about the how important ringing is for us to understand migration, to understand passages of birds, how they're affected, all of these kind of questions. But at the same time, there's something really interesting about being so close to ringing to see how these individual birds were affected, and that kind of tension again between what is needed perhaps for ecology and conservation, things like that, but with the potential harm done to these species or something like that. Something really kind of disquieting about seeing birds like that. So what I'm interested in is how you pull all these different registers of information together, and how when you pull these different registers which have been gathered over time, you start to pull in histories as well. You start to pull in your personal history and your situatedness, and how that starts to create, it's still going to be a partial story of place, but it can be a partial story that speaks in lots of different registers to lots of different things. And actually there'll be different things. When we talk about attunements, there'll be different parts of that kind of work that people become attuned to in different ways.
Mind-blowing. For me, that is mind-blowing, because it also makes me think that what we pay attention to also determines how we move through place and space, which then, of course, determines what we encounter and how our edges are extended into what kinds of encounter. I'm sure there's much to be said along the line, but I wanted just to ask Anu, in terms of extending edges, I was thinking about your attention to and practice of citizen journalism. I'm thinking that perhaps that's another way of extending the edge of mass media and of how we communicate knowledge and information and experience. Is that a reasonable way to think about it?
Yes, I think it can be. And when I was looking at that, that's terrible. I can't look at it, it's casserole. This idea, sometimes I wonder if as researchers and academics and activists, we shouldn't have weeping as part of our methodology. Mm. Mm. And I think there is an element to which in something like citizen journalism, of course there's the challenges there, of course, but where grief can come out, can be outpoured, and that allows a crossing of a particular threshold. And that's, I think, also quite important. Another thing I was thinking of during the landfill presentation was also quite recently there was a case of where a garbage from, I think, Canada was being sent to the Philippines, and dumped in the landfill there, and the Filipino government said actually take it back, please. And that's the case in quite a few, in Thailand as well, that was the case, and also in Sri Lanka, which was actually British waste mattresses or something. And it was really interesting to see the kind of citizen pushback, because it was ecological grief of what has been done to my beautiful land. So I guess in your answer to that, in terms of citizen journalism, we can see that weeping, that grieving, that can be articulated somehow. Yeah.
That's Georgia, Andrew, do you want to jump in at that point?
Yeah. Candy, always have a jump in.
Lean in.
Okay. Yes, I mean, one of the things about this, I'm not quite sure if this is quite heading in the right direction or not, is that I don't know. I've been very much inspired by Pablo Helguera's little book, Education for Socially Engaged Art. Do people know that? Am I pronouncing that right? He called it a methods book, but there's no methods in it. It's just a really nice little essay about socially engaged art. And one of the things he says is that artists and practitioners, creative practitioners, need also to be thinkers, social scientists, and as educators. With equal sophistication to the way in which they think about their creative practice. So, and I think the education thing, as a teacher myself, I think the education thing is really important. So, I suppose the bee in my bonnet about a lot of this is, how do we make this artwork, provocative artwork, act in the world and do something?
Yeah.
In the old days, in the universities, we'd give our students a chapter to read for a seminar. We'd expect them to go away and read it and come back having digested it in a sophisticated way and be able to talk in an erudite fashion about it. And of course, that works for two or three bright sparks in your class, but it doesn't work for the other 20-odd. So in order to animate work, we need to set it in some kind of context. It needs to have something which works around it. And in that sense, we have to think like we're educators. And I think based on some of Andrea Polly's work, Polly, the Sonic Antarctica, and the work she did on, one of the things she did was a thing about car fumes in, I think it was New York actually. So she got a car and she put all sorts of pipes on it and they sat the car at the side of the road and it exuded steam like it was smoke, which drew people's attention. Then she had a group of people, students, who would then go and talk to people, passers-by, who became interested about the issue of pollution from cars.
Yeah.
So there's a sense in which we can present all sorts of stuff to the world, but in order to make it have some kind of effect on people, we need to do something to shape, inform, and direct how people think about it. And that means we have to do the education thing too. And that's not a matter of, and I remember from earlier on, it's not a matter of the dead hand of social science methodology, because the last thing in the world we want to do is kill the sense of creativity, investigation, purpose, etc. So it has to be handled extremely carefully. And of course, if you're a good educator, you don't want to kill that in your students either.
That's a good point.
So it's about thinking about the educational side creatively too, as an artist.
Yeah.
I think that's right, but I think there's space for an awful lot of different ways of art and poetry and writing and creativity. Kath and Jamie has a lovely phrase where she talked about poetry being a line of defence. It might not always be able to be out there fighting, but it can create some kind of way of bringing different things to the fore. And I think there's a danger in people feeling they can do nothing if they're not that kind of socially engaged artist. Whereas I think there's so many different levels in which we can start to raise the questions. And I think what I was
talking about was how you create a critical mass, which actually comes from a lot of different voices and a lot of different perspectives and a lot of different registers coming together. Because it's not, because it's about social engagement, but it's about, as you were saying, Anu, it's not just about ecology, it's about racial inequalities, it's about homophobia, it's about all these different things and how we come together. And actually, one of the words that we haven't actually talked about, but I think is actually really important, is kindness. And I think creating worlds and ways that we can think about what kindness means is a really important aspect of how we think about things like climate change, because it's micro as well as macro.
Yeah.
Just very, very quickly, and that what I've said is absolutely and no criticism of your work. But what it is actually is a plea towards interdisciplinary collaboration, if you like, between educationalists, social scientists, and artists in ways which they not only collaborate together, but begin to understand more of the process and what the other does.
Yes. So it might evolve at different stages, and I think you talked about polyvocal works and multiple forms for the making of work. It feels as though as time passes, we're more and more aware of the need and the inevitability, actually, that creative practice must involve simultaneous or sequential, but multiple forms of expression. I don't think we can rely anymore on the idea of the singular artwork that carries all of those forms of knowledge or question that feels so urgent or present in our lives at the moment. But sometimes that might mean passing the artwork into new hands in order for it to find new kinds of connection. Lisa. What is the utopian method?
That phrase, in fact, belongs to Ruth Levitas. Okay. The idea of utopia as a method for sociology, that sociology ought to become more activist, more engaged, more prepared to build the substance of of imagined alternatives to existing social and environmental injustice. I am a little bit uncomfortable with that, and I'm trying to think about that at the moment. I think this does respond to what we've been talking about. I might need to do a little bit of a loop to get back there. But I think that's because there's a slight tendency in some of that kind of thinking to arrogate the powers of utopianism to certain kinds of specialist thinking and expertise, particularly social scientific expertise. And for me, the joy of working with science fiction, which is a popular form, the particular texts I work with are, generally speaking, not the most popular parts of that form. I'm going to be honest about that. They're very carefully selected, and they're very critically, they're very critically enjoyed. But it is a popular form, and really good science fiction is often better speculative sociology than most speculative sociology. My colleagues might not like me for saying that, but I think it's true. It doesn't need me as an expert to pronounce it as that. And then this question's really interesting for me because I don't think of myself as having a practice. It's not a language that I'm an academic and I'm a social theorist, I suppose. But I'm currently trying to work with readers rather than writers and texts. I need to build a vocabulary for talking about science fiction reading as a social practice, not just as an individual activity, solitary activity. And there's lots of really good writing emerging now around readers. It's linked to fan cultures, but isn't quite that. That I'm interested in, and readers have practices, and those practices are not the same as critical practices. Reading for pleasure, all of us read for pleasure in different ways, I think, than we do when we read to make sense and read to talk to the world about those texts in certain kinds of ways. So trying to engage with what readers are doing or think they're doing when they're simultaneously kind of burrowing themselves in alternate worlds in science fiction and bringing that back to their own lives and biographies is an interesting, non-linear, open-ended process that is really, really, really interesting. So I think part of my work as a social scientist, I increasingly think, is less to do with trying to explain social issues to people, but to understand where readers are encountering, where readers and consumers of popular cultural texts are finding and what they are, how they are engaging and what they are doing. And that's partly a corrective to certain kinds of science fiction criticism, which often has very grandiose claims to make about how science fiction turns us into political activists. But it is also a corrective to the assumption that certain kinds of specialist disciplinary knowledge are needed.
Sorry, just two seconds to jump on that. It was interesting when you talked about that, and this is tangentially connected to what you were talking about, in terms of kindness. When you think of Mark Fisher, because when he writes about pop culture and looking at like capitalism, he says, you know, certain kinds of reading cultural choices or musical choices is about the search for hope, which links to Naomi Nagatullo, who talks about that the ethical problem with capital is that it really is a hopeful project. Yeah. And so perhaps the extraction of kindness from the project of capital is the problem that we're kind of looking at. We want to transform, in a sense, I guess.
Yeah, that's lovely insight.
Sorry.
That's good. Actually, moving on from there, and the idea of hope, I wanted to just raise the issue, the prospect of comedy and comic form within our speculations and our inhabitings of climate change, because I've been very taken by the I think he was an animal behaviorist and a literary scholar, Joseph Beaker, who says that comedy is a strategy for living that actually incorporates a lot of ecological knowledge. He says that, he argues, that tragedy is really specific to Western culture and civilization. In fact, all cultures on Earth draw on comic structure and comic narratives for much of their mythologies and their forms and modes of storytelling. And it's a beautiful and sort of seductive idea, because Meeker then links that to ecological living, ways of living, and he says that the comic character, or perhaps the trickster, revels in maximum diversity. So abundance is central to comedy as a strategy. But they also adapt themselves wherever needed to changing circumstances. So these ideas of adaptability and reveling in diversity and responding to chance and the unexpected, I think are lovely ways of thinking towards resilience, actually. And I wanted to ask Andrew at this point about a project that you were involved in, which is Annika Hansen's Yucca Invest Trading Plant. Do you remember it?
I do. Can I jump in a different place?
Jump wherever you go.
Thank you. Sorry. So just that there was a role happening with what you were saying there, and I think what Amanda said and what I've heard, you know, from across the panel, which is about comedy.
Yeah.
So there's this great phrase by Adam Phillips, which actually you mentioned Darwin's worms, but so Adam Phillips talked about, I can't tell you a funny joke, I can tell you a joke, and you decide whether it's funny.
Right.
And that reminds me about the importance of maybe the comic, but also to do with, if I can make this work, in terms of responsibility. So I have the responsibility to tell a joke, you have the responsibility to process that in whatever way you want, and if you find that funny, then the connection works, the communication works. So there's something to do with the comic being playful, being jarring, being a disconnect that we have to make in our own minds, which is where a lot of comic works. So I appreciate that thought about kind of resuscitating the comic, because certainly when you work all the time, as many of us do with ecological humanities, the comic, it's, you know, there's not a lot of laughs.
Yeah.
You know? But that leads me then to think about this whole notion, which I think you touched on here, to do with earnestness and activism and trying to kind of get an audience to change their minds. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I learned years ago when I was curating that you can't tell an artist what to, you should never tell an artist what to do, and it's kind of, it crosses an ethical kind of line, talking about thresholds. But equally, you know, the artist has a responsibility, I think, to be good, you know, to produce the best that they can produce. So this diversity in what creative practice does, to me, is becoming like more and more important in my thinking. I'm kind of looking to abstract painting, and I'm kind of looking to Mughal painting or Buddhist sand paintings, or, you know, I mentioned three paintings. It could be anything, really, to find something that I might want to take some responsibility to bring an ecological eye to, perspective to, or I might not. You know, you can't live with it all the time, I feel, you know. And so the comic, the change of register, the personal processing that might be, have a lightness to it. Elias, Italian writer, wrote about lightness absolutely beautifully. Calvino wrote about beautifully about lightness. So I feel, you know, amongst the heavy metals here, you know, some levity is a great strategy. Yeah. It's a necessary strategy. Sorry, I haven't talked about the Yucca plants at all.
It's a great project where you've got a Yucca plant participated in the
financial markets,
and bought and sold shares and did about as well as a human.
Hedge fund managers had not a look in.
Which brings me to the next subject, which is John Haraway's idea that the world is our research associate, and that we might actually find a new enthusiasm through curiosity about experiences beyond our bodies and beyond human exceptionalism. Andrew, I know that you're involved in interspecies research. Is that true?
Yeah. I'm really keen to hear what people want to say. I mean, so one of my key principles in the way I navigate this is to look for non-hierarchies wherever I can find them. And that is mainly in justice movements. It can be in political regimes such as anarchism and green thinking. But one of them is definitely in critical animal studies. And that notion of kind of erasing as far as possible the boundaries between the animal and the human animal and the other than human animal, and it takes you in many different directions. But the thing is, so artists are working with this a lot, and I think so many other people in social sciences and sciences are working with this. So I've done a lot of different kinds of projects. Maybe just throw out one which I liked. And it's, and you can find it on YouTube, or a version of it. And it was Jeremy Deller told me about this, and it was the Battle at Kruger, which is a little tourist snap. I don't know if anyone's seen the Battle at Kruger. This is 12, 13 years ago, he told me about this on YouTube. So YouTube was quite new at the time.
Yeah.
And it was a moment that a tourist caught in the state park in South Africa between a crocodile, water buffalo, and lions, and tourists, and they all meet at a waterhole. They all meet at a waterhole. No spoilers. They all meet at a waterhole, and a tussle is caught on camera, very informally, as in front of them, this moment happens between the three species, four species. Tourists is a species. So, I wrote about that. But I think since I wrote about it, it's come to me to mean something about scarcity. The reason why those animals were bumping up against each other were because water is becoming tighter. And you can just project, talk about sci-fi, you can project very quickly in terms of water scarcity that these moments of violence and moments of drama are going to happen across many, many species. They are obviously happening now. But, you know, that Battle of Kruger, that's one example.
Classic
example.
I know, I realise we are totally running out of time, and I wish we weren't. I do want to open up to comments and questions, reflections from the audience. I'd also like to put to you a question that I wanted to put to the whole panel, which really is around this, what do you feel are the skills and the competencies and the capacities and the forms of curiosity that we all need to develop in our creative practice, whatever that consists of, in order to be able to work more effectively, more productively, more kindly with one another and with the other than human world. So this is really, I'd love to do some foraging and some gathering, create an assemblage of those skills and tools if people have anything to say on that. Yes, we've got the microphone coming around, thanks.
It just it helps that, yeah.
Being recorded.
Hi. I'm really glad that you actually mentioned animals, because I was getting a bit worried because the landscape seemed to only have birds in it. And in my mind, animals are also communities across, obviously across the globe. But then there's also a very large amount of farmed animals. But they're really awesome communities, and most of the time they're ignored. So if you look at the globe and where the animals are positioned, obviously anything can be very tiny or it can be quite large, an elephant. And from the point of view of kindness that we just touched on, all these things need to be considered in the landscape. Especially if you think of anything to do with extinction and fighting over water and the river having rights, the animals have rights too. Mm-hmm. So that's just my point.
Thank you.
If you could pass that forward, thank you.
Hi, wonderful, early evening too. Thank you very much. There's so much to think about. I particularly liked giving attention to things, just making us do that. I've got a landscape architect. I know there's a number of other landscape architects in the room, so you start to open up a new language in my head, which is brilliant. But one of the things going around in my head at the minute is, George, you spoke about interdisciplinary work, which we all know we all need to do. And you've shown us different ways of tapping into that in your fields of practice. But have you given any thought to, or does anybody in the room have any thought about how we can relate that to our clients? Because we might have that aspiration and know the necessity of it, but our clients are still working in silos. Maybe with the climate emergency, they'll be able to take a tangential view on things, I don't know. But if anybody's got a comment, I'd be interested. Thank you.
Fantastically interesting observation. George?
I do have a thought about that, and certainly in the world of planning and policy, it's slowly opening out, and partly because planners and policymakers realise they have to take a publics along with them, and they have to take account of the broader complexity of environmental relationships, and therefore take on board all the various different processes and communities and ecologies and constituents that take place. Now, one thing which I think is an important development and something we could all do in our practice one way or another, or one thing, is in terms of bringing heterogeneous bodies of evidence together, I'm quite a fan of this new idea, well, it's relatively new to me, idea of world cafes or evidence cafes, where as part of a deliberative process, you sit down, and my version of it is that somewhere just towards in the first third of the stage, say, okay then, we're bringing all these things to the table, different things, it could be a poem, it could be a map, a body of statistics, whatever it is. So each one of these is going to help us in some way around our problem. What is it that each one will bring which is constructive? So the ground rule is, it's not about what they don't do, it's about what they do do. And by sitting round and taking all this material together and thinking what it might add in a constructive kind of way, it's a way of bringing a whole range of material in one place directed towards a particular problem. But it has to be part of a broader deliberative strategy. And it has to have a few ground rules around being positive and constructive built into it somewhere. That's just one thought.
Just a very quick thought about missing out. I think sometimes a way of persuading people to widen the debate is around missing out. And if they feel they're going to miss out, on an aspect, a dimension, they'll be there. And if they bring something then to the table, whether it's the World Cafe organisation or whether it's a table where something is brought.
But what they're thinking about is money. Public sector is one thing,
yeah.
Planning policy,
yeah.
that's fine. They can, but if it's a private developer, it's still
yeah.
the profit line.
So mm-hmm. so missing out, I mean, obviously we bump up against market forces here, which are beyond possibly, you know, a meeting. But missing out could be overspending. Missing out could be missing something that would be cheaper otherwise. You know, there are logics one can bring. And I just think this idea of the embarrassment of missing out is usually quite a good driver.
You apply that to politics,
then. I like the idea, I think it's Donna Haraway that talks about consulting ensemble, which of course wouldn't work with a developer, but nothing will work with a developer.
That's a lot more manageable. Right? I read it at night.
Is there a developer?
No. There's a lady.
Yes, there are lots of hands up. The woman in the red top, please.
Hi, I'm a new member, and I thank you for everyone's contributions, and I'm here with an artist. Our project is in the Pyrenees, and when I say project, it's because I happen to be someone who owns lands there, forest, orchard, that's been all neglected. The reason I was really interested in discovering this organisation was because the arts synthesis, because my work is all steeped in arts, including education. And in terms of kindness and changing edges and boundaries and responses to climate change and social justice, the emphasis we have is simply to share. So what I'm aiming to do, when I say I happen to be the owner, it really is as simple as that. Because we don't live in a level playing field where we can afford to buy property and land, but somehow my life enabled me to buy this property and land. I find it quite strange, as an English person in the Pyrenees, that I own this land that my fellow neighbours who are born there don't have, or may not even have gardens. So I would really like to find ways of simplifying a response in terms of how we can just simply share land, introduce permaculture approaches, and use art in a highly active way, art and craft in a highly active way. So whilst artists and grass makers can produce very meaningful or beautiful responses, I'm interested in how art acts as a really active engagement tool with the community. It's so hard to talk about land, climate change, social justice for people on maybe a day-to-day level to respond to, but art and craft is often a way in to something that's more complex. And that's really what we're interested in doing with our project. I have left flyers at the back if anyone's interested in that. But I'm just interested in terms of such complex issues, how we actually simplify the responses.
Quick. Sorry, just as you speak, just a really quick. Fernando Garcia Dori is a Madrid artist who I was had a little discussion panel with him last month, and he's a kind of a farmer doing kind of eco practices in the outskirts of Madrid, which does involve some livestock issues and ethical things, which I'm not quite sure I'm happy with myself. But it's highly engaged, it's highly practical, it's very driven by logics of actual farming. But his is an art practice, and he's showing at the Pompidou now, I think. So you know, he's switching both. That's Fernando Garcia Dori, Dory. He's fantastic.
Yeah. I would also suggest do something together. Build a community allotment on your land,
absolutely, yeah. It will be offered up as shares.
Well, I think that to create any project that allows for what Ivan Illich calls conviviality and convivial absolutely. Use of tools is also a way of generating social cohesion, apparently. That's
yeah.
not strong.
Just really quickly, because I do want really interested in how to make that a learning model, how that's disseminated, whether it's through academic research, whether it's through digital social media broadcasting, so that it's reaching as many impact levels as possible.
Well, I'm sure, George, you've got some experience of that.
broadcast it.
Okay, so can I just say something about the gardening thing? I'm thinking of a friend of mine who is a textile artist, works in West Yorkshire, name's Claire Wellesley Smith, and her work is based in old textile communities, and what they do is they grow plants to make dyes, mm-hmm. they research the history of dyeing, they research the history of textile making, they make artworks, they do history, they're convivial. It's a self-help community. Yeah. It brings people together from yeah. all sorts of ethnic backgrounds.
Yeah, yeah. Eat together. Yes, please. Microphone.
I wanted to return to the musical metaphor again, because so much of what's been said has to do with breaking down boundaries between people and dropping pretensions and prejudices and these kinds of things. And there's a wonderful section in Ruth Levitas's book, Utopia's Method, where she brings the music critic Alex Ross in to talk about the music of Bjork.
Uh-huh.
And she says that Bjork's music is utopian because it refuses to pay attention to musical stylistic mm-hmm. boundaries.
Right.
It's willing to bring in influences from classical music, yeah. from pop, from, you know, tube and throat singing, whatever, it's yeah. all in
from
there.
From landscape.
And I think that speaks a lot about the attitudes that we're going to have about landscape in the future if we're going to be able to share spaces, if we're going to learn to drop our pretensions about appreciating perhaps what might be degraded spaces mm-hmm. and learning to find joy in those spaces as well, perhaps building utopias within the future degraded spaces that we may come to encounter or perhaps will come to encounter. So what a question, but
yeah, but a lovely comment, thank you. And I don't know if Bjork created an album called Biophilia, and Bruno Latour says that we must develop a politics in which the role of nature is explicit. That's a pathway for practice, I think. Are there any more questions? I realise we're coming to the end of our time, but we'll.
Yeah, I just have a very quick comment to make, which is from the point of view of being a teacher.
Sorry.
Which is from the point of view of being a yep. teacher. And there's been a lot of comments around listening
yeah.
and around reading.
Yeah.
And the point is so almost banal that I don't know why I'm saying, but I think it's incredibly important because the landscape of a teaching institution, I work with art students and I run a reading group. And that reading group is not unusual, everybody does it. But the process of very anxious art students who feel they've got to produce something, that anxiety of production, slowing down in a reading group mm. where we take 4 weeks to read a small text, mm. and there's a huge international difference in the group. Mm. That's starting at absolute base level of what is required for a landscape, what makes a difference. Mm. It's this level, it's that process. Mm. So, you know, teaching is a creative practice.
Absolutely. Could you go pass backwards to...
It's really just a kind of response to what I've heard, and it's been a very fruitful and provocative conversation and exchange, so thank you all. I think, you know, we've heard about strategies and tactics, you know, the phrase we've used, making strange, bearing witness, re-enchantment, you know, the policy of different tropes that could be there.
Yeah.
And often it's come back to how we mediate the encounter in that landscape context, landscape that we've all recognised as changing, entangled, and emergent. And I think that future-orientated element of landscape as emergent is really is a very powerful arena for conversation and practice. But just to accept a few things that I think I've increasingly taken to my practices, which has been very difficult in certain ways, you know, recognising vulnerability, both personally and you know, collectively, trying to find humility and other forms of sensibility is certainly something that I've been trying to mediate, and I think a part of this conversation, what I've heard from all of you. And also, actually, I thought that the idea of levity was really important. This should be a joyous thing, so finding the wonder and joy and hope in landscape, I think, is also very important.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And yeah, well, Donna Haraway talks about the thriving mess, doesn't she? Which is a lovely way of thinking, and calls it tasty, which I think is kind of fabulous. Yes.
Yeah, very quickly, I'm not going to bother you a lot. I just want to bring your attention on this because he has some clues about the interdisciplinary work with artists. And it's for you also, John. Because I was looking for you. Sorry. it's produced with collaboration with lots of artists and lots of different disciplines anyway, and we finally managed to bring it out. It gives some sense of what people said that they would like to see around. So it's there are lots of copies that
are fantastic.
Because I brought them.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Are there any urgent questions, insistent questions before we wind up? Is there someone there? No?
No.
Okay, we will wind up then. But before we do, I asked Amanda if she would choose a word from the very beautiful Scots Dictionary of Nature, which is a compilation of 19th century Scots words for aspects of and elements of landscape and movement through landscape. It's an absolutely fantastic resource. It's like falling into a deep spring of words that are fitted to place. And
why don't you read it?
No, nope. I want you to read it. I want you to choose the word that I told you to choose.
Okay. And it's a really lovely word, and it's to care, which is C-A-I-R, which means to return to a place where one has been before.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And thank you so much to the panellists and to all of you for being with us, for staying with the trouble for all this time. And may we have the resilience and the curiosity to continue to do that, because we're going to need to in this thriving mess that we're all part of. So thank you so much for being here tonight. Thanks for that.
Can I just say a couple of things? First, if you haven't already made use of it, there's a sign-up sheet here if you want to stay in touch and get further questions about what the group is doing and so on. Please do put your details down on there. I'd also encourage you to become a member. One of the reasons, one of the many reasons, is that we issue a funding call, a grant call, early in the new year, so there'll be a new funding call coming out from our grant scheme early in the new year. And that, the funding call is always based on, or the last few years has been based on, what's discussed at this event in December. So we'll be drawing on everything that's been heard to try and inform that call and try and respond to, therefore, support work which deals with some of these things that we've started putting forward. So if you have an interest in anything this afternoon, please bear that in mind, that we'll be trying to follow this through and other ways to support these kind of conversations and work. So just then, my thanks again, thanks from the group, firstly to you, Ruth, for facilitating all of this, and to everyone on the panel. It's been wonderful. I'd also like to thank Bob, the sentence, that was great as well. Thank you very much for responding in that way. There's a few others as well. Vanessa Lestucci, who's produced the blog series that goes to the events, which you can put this material in the handout, but also on the website. Tim Collins, Gavin McGregor, Tim Waterman for input to forming the event. Of course, Donna Haraway for permission to use that title, and Brandon Belong, if I'm saying that right, that striking image that's been on the slide through the evening. Volunteers from the Barber School of Architecture for helping out, the team at Friends House, and finally, to Sarah Hobbs, who's been keeping quiet over there, for making this assemblage, if I can steal some of the language from this evening, and the driving force behind it, this constellation of stuff that we've had in the room, for bringing things together that otherwise would be usually held apart. Thank you, Sarah. It's been really good. Okay, thank you very much.